Welcome to A Piece of My Mind, a podcast that uses storytelling to bridge divides and build community. I'm John Noltner, and today I'm talking with Lee Bennett Jr., who grew up a few blocks away from Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, and is a longtime member of the congregation. A retired Army officer, Lee spent several years as Deputy Chief of Staff of the White House Drug Control Policy Office and currently serves as volunteer historian for his church. Mother Emanuel has weathered a long legacy of challenges around issues of race, including a 2015 attack by white supremacist Dylann Roof that left 9 people dead.
All right, John, let's get started. What are we going to talk about?
Can you just take a minute and introduce yourself and tell us where in the world we're sitting today?
Okay, well, I'm Lee Bennett Jr., longtime Charlestonian here, born and raised here in Charleston, not far on the east side of the city, which was referred to as the borough, and not far from where the church is located. Now, we're located in downtown Charleston, 110 Calhoun Street. As I mentioned, a native of South Carolina, left South Carolina on to college and then ultimately going into the military. Spent some 24 years in the military. Always had an interesting story. I had never been on an airplane before in my life. So my first experience with an airplane was an airplane I jumped out of. And for at least a year, I'd never landed in an airplane, but took many rides in an airplane. But I spent those years in the military and then certainly retired one day and accepted a job another day as the Deputy Chief of Staff of the White House Drug Policy Office. So I did that work for a while and then transitioned to work border security operations. And so I worked both with the southwest border and the northern border and then continued to do analyst work throughout. I called myself retired, but and I believe I am until someone asked me, could I help with something interesting? So I'm married and with 2 grown children, and we've already talked about my dogs, Harley and Jackson. So that's kind of my background here, and certainly been a longtime member of Emanuel AME Church, where I serve as a trustee here within the church and part of the history committee and other organizations as well. People will always ask me my reaction to the evening of June 17th of 2015. I was not there. So if there are people working up to that, I was not there. I certainly had a conversation with my sister who was there that evening. And I was trying to reach her, you know, earlier. And I remember the timeline and talking with her. I remember she got on the phone once and said, I'm in the middle of a meeting. I cannot talk right now. And if you may recall, it was just not Bible study that was going on that particular evening. They were having a meeting in preparation of a church conference. So they had quite a few of the church people that were in the building at that time. And so then I texted her. She did text me back. And then I finally, she said something to the effect that she wasn't feeling well and she was going to go home. And or she hadn't eaten and she wanted to eat. And she then had a conversation with the pastor just outside of the door of the church going out, and told him she was going home, and she left. Something I actually saw, because I was one that went to the trial for those days, and of course they showed everything, and they had the tape recording and timeline of what was going on. And I saw her leaving and having a conversation with Reverend Pinckney, saying that she would not be able to stay. And she said she felt bad because Myris Thompson had asked her, you know, that would you be here for the Bible study? And she just felt a little bailing on the Bible study. She said she wasn't feeling well. So that's my only connection. And I was certainly in Virginia at the time, and then got a call from her son, and who was living in North Carolina, and said, something is going on. Something's going on downtown. He had no idea it had anything to do with the church. Most people that would not have associated something going on with the church. And I said, no, I don't know what you're talking about. She said, have you seen my mother? And I said, well, I spoke to her. I said, I think she was on her way home, but he hadn't been able to get a hold of her. And then we kind of turned the television on, and then things started developing. And then, so to speak, all hell broke loose then at that point. So that's my connection. And there's more, I get other calls. At the time, I'm not connecting the dots. And then I'm hearing from a cousin, who is my first cousin, but he's married to Felicia Saunders' sister. So when he's calling right from here, and they're moved into a hotel now. And everybody now is getting the magnitude that something happened, something bad happened, but it's worse than anyone could have imagined how bad it was at that point. So I'm hearing that news from him, not putting the connection together. I'm just thinking he is someone else that's calling, but he's actually calling because he's actually here. And he has probably been told that his nephew, you know, was one of the victims. So, no, I was in Virginia at the time. Where I grew up is I grew up on Alexander Street, right here on Alexander Street. Went to school at Buse Elementary. And so my family have always been members of the church, as far as I can remember back, for me, back to the 50s. And so stayed a member. As a member of this community, of course, we can walk to the church from that time. My dad was a church historian. My dad was a chairman and trustee board. But all this goes all the way through my life, then it's high school, and then with most children, there's this break, we're going to college. We go to college, you're still members of the church, you know, you're coming back and forth. And then for me, it's the military. So then that's the largest separation. I can't, you know, there's 5 years in Germany, Korea, Russia. I'm not connected, you know, to the church from that perspective. I mean, physically, because I just can't be. And so we had that distance. So then my connection with the church is always just when I come back. During that time. And then right at the tragedy time period, it kind of intensifies for me more because I'm coming back more. What can I do and how can I help? Certainly, I think I went to five and then maybe more, and it's getting foggy about, I'll say five, and some funerals were combined, five of the nine funerals here. But I'm going, but we're all working. I mean, it's a massive amount of work that just be done. Reverend Pinckney's funeral did not attend. I was in Virginia, back in Virginia at the time. And then my wife and I, in the same time period, we were making the decision that we're coming back to South Carolina, and specifically coming back to Charleston. And so now I have an opportunity to come back permanently here, and that's what we've been doing ever since. But my history with the church certainly probably for me goes back to mid-50s and then beyond. It's the largest African-American church within the city, and it's the largest AME church south of the Mason-Dixon line. And so the architecture is a little bit interesting as we go around. It's a kind of European architecture, Gothic architecture. The choir loft sits in the rear of the church, up top. And of course, the more traditional choir lofts are in the front, but this is in the rear. And so as I kind of close my eyes, it's unusual to be sitting here, not sitting in the church, describing, you know, the church. So I'm doing it off of the memory. Certainly the church has two large, massive murals in the front of the church, one of the crucifixion and one of the ascension. And they were done by an African-American artist by the name of John Green. And they were commissioned in 1945. Now, often people look at these two murals and they look at the pictures. And we now know that they do not represent accurately how people who lived in that region of the world would live. And I remember even as a child looking at the pictures and looking at pictures of Jesus Christ, and I would look and he looked a little, you know, brown skin, but that's not what you saw. But as you realize, these things were done in 1945 in the Jim Crow South. So they were not going to look like anything that what they look like even now.
So is that mural painted so that it is looks like a black Jesus, or is it painted to look like just a white Jesus than its Palestinian Jesus. Heritage would have suggested?
Exactly. Okay. A more white Jesus. And so, and those were the images at a time. That's what you saw. That's what you were taught. You know, this is what Jesus looks like. And so even, as I'm explaining, this is done by John H. Green.
An African-American church,
but done in 1945 in the Jim Crow South. So the idea that it would look any different was not the case at all. Certainly some of the noted speakers within the church, as we learned in our history, Dr. King came in 1962 as a part of the voter rights, voter registration effort here within the South. Coretta Scott King in 1969 to lead the local hospital workers strike, the local union 1199B. And this was soon after the death of her husband in 1969. I do remember that one because I was a part of that particular march as a young person in the march. And my parents were there, but they instructed us to get out of the march at a certain point. Of course, we didn't know why we were getting out. But as the march culminated here at the steps of the church, they were all arrested. And so those were some of the learning things. Many other noted speakers were there at the church. Church was the hub of the community. 1909, Booker T. Washington, here at the church. So it's always been an active part of the community, a dynamic active part of the community. I remember Reverend Glover, one of the pastors here at the church as I'm growing up. Reverend Glover certainly was the president of the local NAACP. You know, he was basically kidnapped and almost beaten to death by the Klan, but he survived. So we talk about a period of time going back to when the structure started, and certainly the architecture for the church was a guy by the name of Devereaux, John Henry Devereaux. Strange background. He's a served in the Confederate Army, captain, but he was the architect for the church of 1891. So let's back up a little. As we start in 1891, because I want to give you the full picture and the rich history of the church. But how do we get there, you know, from here is probably the question. And so let's go back a ways. And I think it's important to even talk about the history of the AME Church, which dates back to 1787. So we're going a ways back. That's 3 years before George Washington is going into the White House in 1790. And of course, we all know the White House is in a different location at that time, and it's in Philadelphia. So if we go back to 1787, our founder, certainly Richard Allen, he and others were members of the White Methodist Church, St. George Methodist Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And so we talk about the fall of 1787. They come into church only to realize that a decision has been made to segregate the church. Now, they didn't know that until they arrived at that particular time. And so when they got there, they realized that they were relegated to the outer fringes of the church on the balcony area. And so they decided to do what they normally did. And so they kneeled and were going to engage in prayer. But they were told by the leadership of the church, you can't pray in that particular location. You have to go to your area. And they said, fine, just allow us to finish our prayer and we will go wherever you're directing us to go. But we understand they were not allowed to do that. So they were forcibly removed from their knees and some sort of thrown out of the church. But that's a culminating event for Richard Allen, Absalom Jones, others. So they decided that they would leave the church in protest and form his own church, which initially was called the Free African Society. So it was the precursor for the AME Church. So we have you in 1787 now with that timeline. But if we fast forward here to Charleston, right in this area, you have Morris Brown. And so Morris Brown and others are members of the White Methodist Church here in Charleston. And not far from there, Bethel was the name of the congregation. So the time period now, you know, in 1816, 1817 time period, so we fast forward from there. And they have, they are members, but the few privileges that they have were being threatened. And I guess the culminating event for them, there was a decision made that the leadership wanted to build a carriage house over the top of the Black burial ground. So that became the culminating event. So he decided that they would leave the White Methodist Church. He would lead them in leaving the White Methodist Church here in Charleston and affiliate themselves with Richard Allen's newly formed church. And when he left, before he did that, he had congregations located in the Ansonboro area of the city, Cow Alley, which is now called Philadelphia Alley, and then a third, more established congregation in the Hempstead suburbs of the city. And a church then is established on the corner of Hanover and Reed Street.
And can you just tell us, Lee, I think I know, but for the, mm-hmm. the people who are listening, can you say what the AME stands for?
AME stands for African Methodist Episcopal Church, and that's the AME. But initially, now we talked about those three congregations that Morris Brown has established, and he called that the Bethel Circuit. So that was the name initially. Now, one of the noted members of the Hempstead congregation was a man by the name of Denmark Vesey. Of course, here we say Denmark Vesey. Sometimes we hear Vesey, but Denmark Vesey. Denmark Vesey certainly was brought here by his master, Joseph Vesey, as an enslaved African, probably in the early 1700s. And in the later 1700s, Denmark Vesey won what was called the East Bay Lottery, some $1,500 is what he won in that particular lottery. And he decided to take some of his winnings and buy his freedom. So he took $600 of his winnings to buy his purchases freedom from his master, Joseph Vesey. Not sure historically why Joseph Vesey would have agreed to that those terms. Denmark Vesey was a skilled craftsman, carpenter, and he certainly could have kept Denmark Vesey enslaved and continued to rent him out for profit. But maybe he needed the money, and so he agreed to the deal. But by law, Denmark Vesey could not purchase the freedom of his wife and his children. So they remained in bondage. Denmark Vesey led the planned slave insurrection here in Charleston of 1822. But as a result of the plan being disclosed, someone told, at least one gentleman by the name of Peter Prelew, told his master. And once the plan was disclosed, some 131 people now are arrested. Many other members of the AME church. And so you got about 92 going to trial. Many are convicted. Denmark Vesey and five others are executed on July the 2nd of 1822. They're hung. And on July the 22nd of 1822, you have 26 African-American men all hung at the same time. The newspaper article said that they were placed in horse-drawn carriages, made to sit on their coffins, and paraded around downtown, and then taken to a place called the Lines, where they were hung. The gallows were poorly prepared. The article describes somewhat of a carnival atmosphere. At least one person was killed just watching this hanging. A horse ran over them. Because the gallows were poorly prepared, many of them were shot in the back of the head. So when it was all said and done, you had 35 people who were hung. And then following that, some of the citizens of the city decided that they would burn that church to the ground. So that's the church located on Hempstead, in the Hempstead suburbs, and on Hanover and Reed Street. And then the laws, some laws that were on the books, were vigorously enforced. They were already there, but now they're being vigorously enforced. Laws like the Negro Seamen's Act of that time, which essentially said that freed sailors, black sailors that came into ports of Charleston, were removed from their ships and then placed in the city jail, and they had to remain in the city jail until their ships left Charleston.
And because they didn't want a freed black person putting ideas
exactly
in the head of an enslaved black person.
Exactly. That's certainly, if not the sole factor, the large part of what was there. So they were placed in the city jail. And in some cases, if their someone decided that a ship captain needed to pay a particular fee, and if he didn't pay that fee, you could have free black men who were then sold back into to slavery. So that was the Negro Seamen's Act. Certainly, Nat Turner's Rebellion then takes place in 1831. And so the climate continues to heighten, and South Carolina passed legislation that said there would be no African Americans worshiping in churches from 1834 until 1865. And certainly
31 years.
Yeah, in 1865, then the Civil War ended. And once the Civil War ended, the Hempstead congregation, who was not supposed to be worshiping legally during that particular time,
but did in some fashion, I'm sure.
And they did, and underground and in secrecy. And so they reemerged in 1865 and purchased the land on this site here. Now, the street out front is called Calhoun Street. Back then, it was called Boundary Street. And it's Boundary Street. There was probably no chance of purchasing land south of Boundary Street. And so on this side of the street, would it be considered outside of the city limits, where you're in the rural area outside of the city limits, where you had probably less restrictions, less problems. Not no restrictions, no problems, but less. And so the decision was made to purchase on this side. So that congregation reemerges some 3,000 strong and lays the cornerstone for a church. Now, at the same time, a gentleman by the name of Bishop Payne reemerges some 30 years to the date. So where was Bishop Payne? Well, Bishop Payne ran a school here in Charleston. He was very passionate about the education and teaching. But he ran a school on Trad Street. But it was deemed illegal for him to teach African Americans to read and write. So he's sent away in exile. And he comes back almost 30 years to the date to help reestablish the church. And that's what he does. And he selects Reverend Kane, as we mentioned when we started out, as the first pastor of Emmanuel. So now they're laying the cornerstone, and the church is built in 1872. And it's a wooden structure and a capacity of about 2,000. And that's the church that Reverend Kane is preaching from. But that church was destroyed by the earthquake of 1886. Here in Charleston. So as a result of the church being destroyed, now the church is rebuilt again in 1891, completed in 1892. And that's the edifice that we're talking about that's here. So as we talk about the history of the church, and certainly a part of our history, certainly is the incident of June 17th of 2015, where we have nine members of the church were murdered during Bible study. As a young man comes in to be a part of the Bible study class, and certainly he is invited in. He asks for the pastor. The pastor introduces himself and sits him right next to him. And so the Bible study goes on for almost close to an hour. And as the Bible study was over, as they would always traditionally do, they rise and in prayer to pray, close their eyes, and he shoots the pastor first. And then continues shooting the others. When it was all over, certainly within the fellowship hall, we had nine people who were killed and three survivors in the fellowship hall. and the two additional survivors, the pastor's wife and his daughter, who were in the office at the time. This church is a resilient church. And I think to tell the church's story, you know, over 200 years of history, I don't think many people realize how far back the church goes. We lost 9 people during that time. We lost 35 others back in 1822, and they were all hung. We are a resilient church, and we're going to be around for another 200 years and some. We're in the process now of doing renovations on the church. Certainly we're honored that we will never forget the Emmanuel Nine, the survivors, the victims. And so there is a memorial that's being planned and will be erected here at the church. Michael Arad, the same architect that did the 9/11 memorial, is working with the foundation on the memorial here. So there's a rich history, certainly within the church. And these are just parts. Each one of these stories has its own story within. Certainly with Richard Allen, Absalom Jones, Denmark Vesey, and others. There is a monument in honor of Denmark Vesey that sits in Hampton Park on the west end of the city. And you may have mentioned that you were already there.
Yeah, I visited that already. And it was, I'll be honest, it was the first that I knew of Denmark Vesey. And so it was an education to go to that site and read the information there.
Well, and it's pretty interesting. You said the education is as I live pretty close to that location, and I remember being in the park one day, and a lady came by. She had her children. She had one in the stroller, and she looked up and she says, "Oh, Denmark Vesey," and I recall her saying, "Oh, he must have been from Denmark," and she continued on. And one of the changes that was made, and you may have noticed, is that the monument now speaks to you, and so it has an audio that all you have to do is use your phone.
And, and then it calls you.
And it calls
my
you.
My wife and I listen to
it. And it gives you stories. So that was one of the changes that took place to make sure that the story is told. Certainly for years, growing up, just still whispers of Denmark Vesey.
Let me just add in there that as I was trying to search where exactly the statue mm-hmm. was and find the exact location so we could walk to it, I also saw some of the comments that were written below, because the statue's mm-hmm. only been there less than 10 years,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. But there was clearly some resistance to placing that statue there.
Yes. Yes. Well, and interesting, and I'm not sure which way it went, whether it was total resistance of even honoring Denmark Vesey in the first place. A large group revering him as some sort of terrorist. And so why would we honor Denmark Vesey? He was a terrorist. His plan was to kill all these people. And so that's still a form of discussion. And I would submit that it sits in Hampton Park. Also, too, another form of discussion named after former Governor Wade Hampton, who probably owned more slaves than anybody else in South Carolina. But that's where it sits.
But that's sits not viewed as terrorism, owning those slaves and controlling those people. Well,
and here lies. So you have someone You can say it's analogous to what did we do? What did George Washington do and others? I mean, we were trying to free ourselves.
Well, this is the great irony that I kept thinking of when I was at the statue, that 50 years before, a bunch of white people took up arms because they were worried about taxation without representation. So they took up arms to battle to get their independence. But then 50 years later, Denmark Vesey does essentially the same thing. He takes up arms. Yeah. Well, he plans to take up arms.
Plans.
to battle for independence, for freedom. Mm-hmm. But then he's viewed as a terrorist.
As a terrorist.
That discrepancy in how we view the heroes and the heroes. Fathers exactly. versus that quote-unquote terrorism is a remarkable blindness.
And it is, and it had created. We don't tell the full story, because certainly those are not things that we were taught. We were still operating, and even in my days in school, we're operating over books that are influenced. We had the Sims history books. Many know that those books. In South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, all throughout the South, were deeply influenced by the Daughters of the Confederacy.
So and, it was the white narrative that was
the white
presented.
Narrative,
and that was the Sims
history book. And so, here's the discussion that even still goes on today about, especially within in the South. Civil War had nothing to do with slavery. We're still in that realm of this is how we view the world and how we teach. We've been teaching history, and not perhaps telling, well, not telling the whole and full story. And it could be uncomfortable to sit across from each other and have. A discussion about what happened and the whole story. But we have to tell the truth. And we have to tell the truth in a place that calls itself a historic city. But yet we're still resistant to telling the truth. I think it largely makes people uncomfortable. But that's okay.
I think that discomfort is where change can happen.
It can. If these are, don't go about whitewashing it, if these are slave quarters, don't call them servant quarters, nobody's getting paid to render that service. And that's that degree of, I don't want to make it uncomfortable for you. Denmark Vesey's, it was a decision to have a mural, a portrait of Denmark Vesey. And it was placed in the Gilliard Auditorium. But it didn't last but a couple of weeks before it was stolen. Someone took it down. And so the mayor at the time made a plea that put out a reward of $200 and just bring it back. And no questions asked. And it did come back, and someone placed it at the back door of the auditorium. It's kind of interesting, $200. Then obviously took $600 to buy his freedom, but the $200 one. It came back, but it went up with no the plaque beneath it. So you really didn't have any idea.
No context.
Of who this was. And it's interesting to see whether it's still up, and I don't believe it's up to this day. Someone said it had made its way back to another place to be displayed, which ends up being the old slave mark. So that's an interesting circle that that mural now ends up in the old slave mark. So we have a ways to go in terms of being able to tell the full story, understand how unfair and unequitable, you know, the history displays are in a lot of cases. And if we just are not quite there yet. But of course, in my lifetime, you know, as it connects to the church, I mentioned to you that the church certainly was destroyed by the earthquake of 1886. And our records indicate that the then president of the United States at that time decided he would make a donation to the church of some $10. And I guess the words was for a worthy cause to help with reconstructing the church. But we also understood he gave $20 to the Daughters of the Confederacy to help with the statue project for John C. Calhoun to help raise it some 65 feet. So I mentioned it for years, my lifetime. It was always been there in Marion Square. And just recently, before you got here, it had been removed. Now, this has been removed in 2020, as many monuments throughout the United States have been removed. But I would never have thought that that particular symbol had been removed. And so we always have a discussion about, well, you can't change history. Nobody was trying to change history. John C. Calhoun's history is there. It will be here with us. And if you want to look it up, it's there of who he was. He served as a vice president and so on. But symbols are what we're looking at. And symbols in terms of what's equitable and fair. Growing up, I knew nothing about the 54th Massachusetts Regiment at all and their history here within the city and the battle at Morris Island. It's never discussed. Fort Sumter was discussed, but nothing about Morris Island at all. And even today, as I would go around the Battery of downtown, in order to read something, there's a plaque, but it's on the ground. So you have to get down on your knees and read it, and it points out to the area of where Morris Island are. But as you turn behind you, these massive monuments and statues that embrace the lost cause ideology and embraces the history of what went on with the Confederacy. So the balance is completely skewed.
I don't know if you know this connection to Minnesota, mm-hmm. but Calhoun also helped establish Fort Snelling,
yeah.
which is at the confluence of the Minnesota and Mississippi rivers. So we had a lake that was named Calhoun.
Calhoun.
I didn't realize until I was down here that this was the same Calhoun that we're
John
talking about.
C. Calhoun.
But I think it was last year, maybe the year before, they voted to strip the name Calhoun
yes.
from one of the lakes
yes.
in Minneapolis, and they've changed it to Bede Makuska.
Yes.
Which is the traditional Native American name for that
yeah.
lake. So I see some movement
mm-hmm.
towards recognizing the importance of that
mm-hmm.
symbolism. In fact, if you look at that book, one of the
mm-hmm.
stories
mm-hmm.
is Myron Fourier, who's the great-great-grandson of Black Elk.
Oh.
And he was working with others to change the name of Harney Peak in South Dakota, which was named after
mm-hmm.
a general who
sure.
massacred a bunch of Native American people
sure.
to rename that Black Elk Peak. And just as that book went to press, they succeeded.
Mm-hmm.
So I see, and
yes.
and you said as well, you said the Calhoun Monument was taken down?
Yes. So in your lifetime, you can go now, and there's a talk around it. It has been removed. John C. Calhoun came down. I'll share with you some pictures. But I would have never thought that there was a pathway that certainly we would hear all sorts of reasons why it could not come down and what vote was required and miraculously, they found out that maybe they always knew that this didn't apply. This was given to the city. And so the city always had the option as the city and city council to vote to have it removed. And historically, I see these ironies that it was the city council that decided the fate of Denmark, BC, and others. City council did that. I mean,
back to those times.
So you're talking really, kind of the mayor and others made those decisions, and yet we had this long-term battle and excuses of why we could take no action there. And the other part is it's amazing that we have to go through so much pain to make movement. It shouldn't take 9 people losing their lives in a church to have a discussion about a Confederate flag and how that symbol makes certain people feel and be willing to have that discussion of why it's not a good idea to have a Confederate flag flying over the state capitol. But yet it did, and yet it continued, and yet it looked as if there would be no pathway to seeing or entertaining removing it. But until 9 people were killed. But even then, there's the groundswell of not now. But if not now, when? But through history, now you're being revealed. Do you realize that 35 people were hung for a planned slave insurrection? And you're telling a congregation here in 2015 that now is not the time to talk about removing another symbol. But that's because we have a lack of understanding of where we were in the history. More people, be it the factor being the, you know, the tragedy, but they are learning more about the true history of the church. And learning about people like Denmark VC and others, and that story being told. And then you're being able to connect the dots to other things and have an appreciation for how it makes people feel. When you talk about changing names, Ben Tillman, and others, another one, Ben Tillman's, let's take a Clemson University, and you have dormitories named after Ben Tillman. But this is the same Ben Tillman who, when Booker T. Washington, you know, invited to come to the White House, says to the then president, if you allow that person, and he didn't say that person, to come to the White House, we will lynch 1,000 Negroes. And he didn't say Negroes. And those are his words. And those words are recorded because of the place he said those words from. And so this is the same Van Tillman involved in the Hamburg massacre, where you have a pastor forced to kneel and shot in the back of the head. And he tells stories about his involvement in that incident. So to have, then you have your young daughter, age 17, and you're taking her to a dormitory named after Ben Tillman. It's not about you have to understand the symbolism and how it makes people feel, and at least have room to think, this is not right, and we can do better. His name doesn't have to be there. And there are others that are still there. The story of the father, the doctor who calls himself the father of gynecology. And his monument still sitting on, you know, Capitol grounds.
How yeah, makes in Montgomery, people right?
That's right.
I was there the last year, and I was at the Equal Justice Initiative started a new museum.
Nice.
In there, it talks about that on his history
yes.
and how he had done experiments
it's on experiments on black women. Yes.
But so there was the truth there. But then a couple blocks away, as I was walking downtown, yeah. there was one of those little historical markers that talked about how wonderful this doctor yes. was and how we learned so yeah. much about gynecology. Yeah. And right there in yeah. 2019,
wow.
two completely different narratives.
Two completely narratives.
And I think we know which one is true.
Yes. So we have to tell the complete story. That, to me, is the history. Now, and it's uncomfortable in that regard. But should he, should that be revered that we're going to name a hospital after him? Makes no sense at all. Just especially if we're talking about everybody and all people and how it makes people feel.
Can I just ask you on a, mm-hmm. a personal level, when that statue of Calhoun came down, what does that symbolism and that choice to remove, what does that mean to you?
Well, growing up, every day, personally, I would have to go to the library. And so as a child, I'm going to the library. And you almost would not want to, but could not resist. You don't want to look up. And the way it's positioned, and this huge monument, and he kind of has his hands on his hip.
You're saying when you went to the library, you could see that Calhoun monument.
You can see it almost every day of your life. And so you have to go back and forth. Of course, we as African Americans, we know who he is and what he represents. And so you're asking yourself, but how can this be? You know, and do you really matter? Do you really matter? More importantly, how you feel? Does that really matter at all? And you have to, you know, bring yourself to believe that, well, really, I don't. How I feel does not. So the idea that, and you try to avoid it, but it's in a way, in a deliberate way, that how can you avoid it? And that's how it's raised. It has a history that it never was that high, even when it was first erected. It was in a lower area. But what happened? It was desecrated all the time. And who was probably the chief people desecrating it? African Americans. Through history all that time. And so it's found a way that we're going to kind of rule over you. And that symbol had been there, a divisive symbol, very divisive symbol. You know, very clearly his stance, you know, on slavery and how he viewed African Americans. So I mean, if you talk history, history is clear. So it was, I just couldn't imagine that I would live long enough that in fact would be removed. And I was fortunate enough, as you say, God put you in the right place and all. I could have been anywhere else in the world. So I go back to other decisions of when I made a decision to come back home and to be able to stand there as it's being removed, and to get through that battle. And there are others, and there are others that are there that, you know, I live across the street from a stadium. I live near the Citadel, and the Citadel's own history and its connection to Denmark VC and to the church. But that's where I live. And there's a stadium, the football stadium. massive stadium directly across the street from my house. And all those years called Johnson Hagedorf Stadium. I have no idea who was Johnson Hagedorf. And as a child growing up, I don't know who's Johnson Hagedorf at all. But Johnson Hagedorf, as I understood, and going into the military and understanding military history, and this history that I ran away from all my life, he is the general that's leading the battle against the 54th Massachusetts Regiment. So,
which was a black,
which was the yes, if you remember the movie Glory,
yeah, yeah.
With Denzel Washington, that's the same regiment. So he's leading that battle. He is his decision in battle. No quarter was given. Even when the outcome of the battle was decided, not at all. So, but he's revered. His name is on this massive stadium. You can't escape it. It's a part of your day to day. So every day I come out of the doors. Look up, it's Johnson Hagedorf Stadium. But we must tell the whole truth. And we have to have balance. So if we know why a lot of these things were done in the early days, is it time to have the discussion, have the balance, and say perhaps we can do some other things. So that was a start. Calhoun. But there's a lot of work to be done. And sometimes what's referred to as the Confederate Disneyland. We have work to do in that regard.
Are you hopeful that we're making progress?
Well, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful. Because if you'd asked me that, I saw it. And I saw that happen. I'm a little bit, it's something that's hurtful that it shouldn't take the sacrifices, for that to happen. But certainly that's happening in the climate of George Floyd and the incident following and the crying for a balance and, social justice. But without that, it's not happening. It's not happening. So it's a great price that is paid to, in some view, do the right thing. So it's cautiously hopeful, but the price is great to, and that's what I'm seeing. 9 lives lost. To remove a flag from the Capitol. A man choked to death. To remove it. That's a great price to pay to start these dialogues and to recognize the imbalance. And we're not telling the whole story or everybody's story in that regard. So, cautious with the hope. It's hope at a cost.
Yeah. There's an idea that I'm not sure how to say, but as a middle-aged white guy, standing on the steps of Emmanuel, Mother Emmanuel Church this morning while I was just waiting those couple minutes for you. That as I don't know how it felt heavy, right? That was someone who looked like me that did this horrific thing to someone that looked like you. And in the midst of being welcomed and invited into a community of faith that violated in the most horrific way, how do you move beyond that violation to again trust and embrace people? Does that make sense?
It makes sense But I would say to you, certainly there was an objective, maybe with a sort of misguided objective this young man has. And certainly he had others supporting it. Perhaps this could be a paradigm shift, and perhaps we can get into some type of racial war and big divide.
That was part of his change.
That was part of when his manifesto. That's part of the goals. And we as a people, I guess the belief that you can't change who we are, and that's we're not going to allow that to happen. So I say to you, and even when you go back and you ask me about AME, and I'll tell you a story, and certainly as people were coming to the church in the name African Methodist Episcopal, perhaps gave some people a pause until explaining, you know, well, what is this all about? Because they would ask the question, are we welcome? And so you'd have a shocking list of, of course you're welcome. And you said, well, what is this all about? But certainly explain, you know, African, certainly our founders are descendants of slavery. And so that part is race and Methodist. That's the who we are. Episcopalian, you know, it's kind of the order of the hierarchy and how we have bishops. How we do things within the church. So those names were all a part of how the creation of the what Morris Brown had in mind. Richard Allen had in mind in terms of who we are. But it never was to in terms of separation at all. So all are welcome. All have always been welcome. Even here in our area, you see where we sit, where the church is. So the church is in downtown. So it wasn't unusual to have people, in my view, people who look differently from us, to be within the church. It's always been the case within the church. And it's God's house. The doors of the church are always welcome. That has not changed. And you have, the more important, you have not changed who we are. At all. No one has. He certainly has not. And we haven't changed our approach to what we do. Well, lots of discussion about what you should be doing. You should have metal detectors. You should have, no one should be allowed to come in. We're going to have restrictions on, well, white, black, you know, none of that. That's not who we are. And we trust, certainly in God and our faith. Do we do things that make sense? Yes. I would be, less than honest to tell you if we recognize that perhaps there are some things to do, but in the spirit of making you feel comfortable, making you feel safe. Should we lock a door? I grew up in church where nobody locked the door. That's just what, you know, most churches, nobody did. And even when you locked them, they were so old that when you pushed them, they came open anyway. But things like cameras, lighting, those type things perhaps make sense to do. And so we would do those things in the spirit of making you feel safe, but welcome. It's not mine to advocate. It's the Lord's house, so the doors of the church are open to all people. What we do to make our children, guests, and families feel safe, we do those things that we can do within our power. But we have not changed who we are in that regards, and how we do business in that regards. And it's certainly been heightened. It was just a degree of not in God's house. And we saw that somehow within the country and within the world, that door got opened. we grew up with that, there were just certain things that just were not going to happen. And it's just sad that that door got open and you started hearing of other places and other cases and should never be open. But the people have to remain resilient. The people have to believe what they're taught. And they do. They do. And the history also is a factor, because as we started with this, very, very struggling, tough times. So not the first time. The tragedy is certainly knocked on the doors. We pray for that never again, but not the first time. So interesting.
Well, Lee, I feel like I could talk to you all day. This is all.
We can.
This is all fascinating. It helps. Uh-huh. It helps me connect a lot of dots, and I'm grateful for your time.
Well, I'm grateful for the opportunity to have a conversation, and I hope that in trying to remember what I could remember, and that some of it you can find useful.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. As we close, thinking about everything we've talked about, thinking of ways that we can build healing in the world and that we can bring people together the way they need to be brought together, what do you have any parting thoughts? Do you have any parting wisdom?
I think we owe ourselves to tell the truth once. And I think that the church as a whole has a large part in that. And as uncomfortable as it may be, the church has to take the responsibility to tell the truth, and the church's role, in fact, it was played. You got to remember, we started off, and look at the irony, we're starting off in the 1700s, and not 1787, and we know what was going on in the years just before that. But we're forming this thing. It's flawed from the beginning. And so that's how we're taking off. And we continue that way. You know, we still have people talk about the most segregated day in the world is Sundays, where people are going there their different ways. And we talk about friends. Is it really friends? Go to people's funerals and look. And you look around and you said, either everybody looks like me or everybody looks like you. But there should be some type of blending. So I guess my thoughts are then, you got to tell the truth. And as uncomfortable as it may be. And we have to recognize that taking our roles to fix things. And it shouldn't be on the burden of the oppressed people to say, I got all the answers. You know, we're all in this together. So those are kind of my thoughts. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes sense.
It makes good sense. I appreciate your time. I'm glad to know you, Lee.
Hey, same here. Good to meet you.